It transformed theories, accepted quantum mechanics on superposition, entanglement, and quantum tunneling.
So, time travel is possible?
Really?
But, wait a minute, what about the speed of light and infinite mass and all that?
Well, I've thought about that.
Oh, she's thought about it.
A call for help embedded in a piece of wood from a burned-down barn. A rare glass 78 recording. A theory of time travel and quantum superposition. And most importantly, the voice of a strong-willed African-American jazz pioneer, Kit Jeffers. These are the main components, the main things that had to be discovered in the Embers. Great Northern Audio's feature-length, multicast audio production. I'm Brian Price.
And I'm Jerry Stearns.
Together we developed, wrote, directed, and produced this audio recording. We've been asked to put together a little making-of documentary about how all the pieces, the acting, sound effects, and the music all came together to make the play.
But he's awful sweet, that gorgeous boy.
Brian and I have been working together for 20 years. And we'd both been writing and producing audio before that for some time. And when we talked about where we wanted to go in the field, there was a lot of overlap. In all that time, Brian has been reviewing audio pieces, other people's work. And I've been broadcasting it on community radio in Minneapolis for over 30 years. So between us, we'd heard an awful lot, many, many hours of other people's work, what everybody else was doing in the field. We knew what was out there. We kind of knew what wasn't out there, too. So when we began talking about In the Embers, we had an idea that we wanted to take our work to another level, get further away from the old-time radio style and much more into the realm of an independent film.
With In the Embers, we found something really special, something you don't run into every day as a writer or a producer, a story that's going to affect you. It's going to take you someplace, and you're not going to be the same after it. Digger and Kit, Old Alice, storyline, music and history in the Embers created their own world. It became so real to us, and what we wanted, what we stylistically was to have it sound like a film, sound so real and absolutely believable.
In telling the story of In the Embers, we tried really hard to work against the natural linearity of the audio medium and not tell the story in a chronological order. It makes it more interesting to listen to. This documentary is kind of the same way. We can't tell it in a linear fashion.
I keep wanting to talk about everything we did at once.
So we thought we would break it up into topics, like the story, and the actors, and the music.
What are you?
Well, what do you mean, what am I? I am Kit Jeffers.
You've got to be more than a bunch of ones and zeros. What is this?
Well, I know I ain't no ghost. I know that. I'd know if I was a ghost, because I'd scare myself. God, I did believe in ghosts when I was a baby. I remember. You grow up in the country with old folks all around. You grow up in the South. You see them out in the fields.
The story.
So we're driving across the Midwest, Missouri and Illinois, and I throw out the idea of a librarian as a main character. Well, that started us bouncing ideas around, and we're following this thunderstorm. So there's this gorgeous lightning show ahead of us, and we're beginning to throw out ideas and character names and lines of dialogue. And I'm trying to take notes in a moving car, which made a lot of them hard to read later. The librarian became an archaeologist, which brought up the idea of audio archaeology. There's time travel involved. There's music involved. It's really hard to remember now who came up with which idea.
just went back to an early version of the script, and it's interesting to kind of search around and say, okay, what did we know, because you learn so much writing a script, and you things develop, and you don't even remember when they weren't developed. The idea of the artifact, the sound recording, accidentally recorded in wood, was there right in the beginning. We had that, and we knew pretty much what they were going to say and how they were going to say it. The next thing that showed up almost immediately was the record store scene. So we were searching right away for a way to talk about the sound recording and how, and the mystery of who was in the sound recording. And so that was there right away. The other thing that I saw was there was already a paragraph about time travel. So that was in the mix immediately. ZBS founder, producer, engineer, Tom Lopez.
The idea that that sound is captured in substances, wood in this case, and it can be extracted, is there's some scientific backing for all this. I mean, right from the beginning, because I had read about that possibility, a couple of years ago. Then for you guys to show up with a script saying, okay, look what we got. Who knows? This may be possible. But then taking the idea and bringing in the character that Robin played, God, she's good. And the singing, too. I mean, the songs are really, really great. It was exciting production to work on.
We'd been doing a lot of science fiction over the years because we had a venue and an audience for that. And here we were telling a modern story, so you kind of couldn't avoid the fact that there was technology in use in the story. But it turned out that we used the technology very much to tell the story as well. We wrote a lot using Skype as a communication device. We would talk live, and then one of us would be typing the script on a computer at the same time.
The story was going to have to take place in the South, so we're going to have to say something about Black culture. It was around. If you were white, you just didn't know about it. You weren't going to be told about it. I grew up in Arlington, Virginia, which is across the river from Washington, D.C., and history just oozes out of every pore of every place around there. The streets are named after Civil War generals. The schools are named after famous plantations. You just can't get away from it. But the very real thing back when I was a kid in the 60s and 70s was Virginia, Maryland, D.C. were still pretty segregated, and certainly much more so in the early part of the 20th century. But not only were the people segregated, but the history and the culture were segregated. There was obviously a long, proud tradition of Black schools, clubs, nightclubs, churches, stores, newspapers. I had the honor to meet and interview back in 1977, Arthur Carter, who was the editor and publisher of the Afro-American, and interviewed him about Negro League baseball. The Homestead Grays played in D.C. back in the 30s and 40s. That was really neat. But I think the point is, if you were white, you weren't going to be told about other cultures. You weren't going to find out about it in schools. Nobody was going to tell you. You'd have to dig it up for yourself. Actress, musician, and one of our favorite radio hosts, Jackie Maddox.
As an African-American woman, I recognize the script and the storyline to be authentic as well. I have to hand it to the writers and producers of this piece, In the Embers. There was just something very honest and authentic about the flow of the conversation, about how everyone would have responded to one another. As an African-American person, I really am thankful that it rung true. I mean, something like this could have gone off kilter or off track or off key, so to speak. Instead, it didn't. It went to a very authentic, real place that makes me wonder if you don't have some African-American roots of your own, because the storyline did ring true, and all the information, including the person that Kit Jeffers would have married, end up marrying Alice instead, because Kit had passed away. So in real African-American communities, that the grieving process would have brought those two people together. And in reality, the husband would have ended up with Alice. That's true. Things like that, those pieces of information made that script ring true. And I have to congratulate you on that authenticity.
Got to be able to feel the book and smell it.
Not sure how you do that. I don't think they've digitized smells.
My mama's Bible smells so good. Like lilacs and leather in her. I used to sit by her in church with my white gloves and my dress and flip the pages looking for four-leaf clovers and columbine blossoms that she pressed in there. Deuteronomy was all stained up with the flowers that she pressed. She figured nobody would want to read that part anyway.
How do you have memories?
How do you possibly have memories?
What wouldn't have memories? Everything has memories. A tree has memories. A dog has memories.
But does a rock have memories? Do elements have memories? Do the basic things that make up other things remember? That's the...
You want me to philosophize? I'm going to need a drink.
So you want a drink and a Bible?
Sounds like my daddy.
Yeah, mine too.
Digger says, mine too. And I don't know, that just appeared. I was just typing away and mine too came. And all of a sudden we knew a whole bunch about why Digger and Kit had a connection. You know, it was a very human connection. And the actors knew where to go with that line. And I'm really proud of that because it said to me that, you know, the characters were starting to speak for themselves.
The actors.
To get a cast, we didn't have to step as far outside of our zone of comfort as we thought we might. We did put out a casting call, and I recorded a lot of local people's auditions, but we still ended up with a number of people that we had worked with before. Dawn Krasnowski, who played Susan, we had worked with before in some of our live stage shows. She was in rehearsals to play a Klingon in a stage production in the near future. Dean Johnson is a local stand-up comic who had worked with us before. He played Epstein, the record store owner, and he lives about a block from a record store very much like the one we had the character in. Gordon Smooter, who was one of the graduate students, he's a puppeteer by trade, so we knew he could do audio performance. Suzanne, who played the other graduate student, she's part of a local band, an Irish band called The Dregs, and we knew other people in that band, so she kind of came to us obliquely. Tom Joyal, he was Behringer, the big contractor. I'd done some sound effects with the local group who did old-time radio performance at senior centers and such, and Tom was one of the actors in that, so I really knew what he was capable of and what kind of a powerful voice he had. We had tried earlier in the year to get a cast together, and it just was not working out for us. There were so many impediments. But I asked the cast when we got them together in December to record and found out that we would not have been able to get any of them if we had done the recording earlier in the year. So I'm really glad that it worked out when it did.
Robin Miles was definitely our first and really only choice for Kit. There just wasn't anybody else. It was just a matter of us fitting into her busy, busy world of narrating and producing audiobooks. I'd worked with Robin before, once she was a lead actress in a play I directed, and once she directed one of our plays. She comes out of Yale Drama School, and there's always this intelligence and beauty and confidence swirling all around her. I love it, because as a director, you've got to be on your toes. Once Robin commits to a character, she's going to keep pushing and pushing until she gets every feeling, every nuance, exactly right in the recording.
Well, luckily, I happen to do, or have done, I guess I should say, a lot of work in this time period. I kind of consider it one of my comfort zones, that in the 1800s. Just ended up doing a lot then. And I know under Calvin Coolidge, it was a tough time for the have-nots. He was very much about the haves, the ruling elite. And so one of my perspectives is that she's living in a landscape where the government is, again, the whole government around her, including the society, is really not friendly to the have-nots, and particularly the black have-nots. So, as I said, I kind of know this era a little bit. So I plowed through some of my books. I like to listen to 1920s jazz. I always have, actually. My dad was a jazz musician, and I used to sing in a restaurant. So I used to pull from this era. I did a show on Broadway, actually, where my character was a jazz singer, and the year was 1919, after the troops were coming home. Many of the troops were coming home from World War I. So, again, I've done a lot of that background work, and it flowed really, for me, pretty seamlessly into working on Kit.
What do I sound like?
I don't know. You sound like you're in a tin cup, like a radio.
Here, there. Camera should be on. Can you see me? How do I look?
Edwin was probably the last guy we cast, so we ended up casting Digger, the most important male in the cast, last. And we went through a pile of people, and finding Edwin was so important and such a joy to work with. He was a trained stage actor, and he knew what to do. He knew that he had to play a real person, and he had to embody, reactions that made sense. And, this was not a cartoon character. And so it had to be subtle. And he was a reaction character. He was reacting to, a ghost in his computer and a finding sound in a barn on a piece of wood and watching fantastic things come about. And Edwin took all that in stride. Very, very professional, and he just came and nailed it down. And that was very important, to have a strong actor set up to play against a strong actress, who's Robin Miles.
Well, this was a unique audio work. I don't do a lot of voiceovers, but like I said, you're usually alone in a room. Just a little box. But so this was just great. It was fantastic. It was more like doing a stage reading of a play, a new play. So you could play with the other actors. Hit the microphone. I'm very animated.
Yeah, that's okay.
You're a stage actor.
Yeah.
That's what you do.
Yeah. But no, it was great to be able to play off of everyone being in the same room at the same time. I think it went a lot quicker and smoother that way, and it was able to be much more honest and in the moment. I thought it was great.
This would have been a difficult one-sided record if I had someone just feeding me lines in. I don't think I could have found some of the things that I found. But I will say, having worked in the audiobook industry for as long as I have, I'm used to putting myself in the position of the stakes for both sides. Being in the audiobook industry, I have to think from both sides anyway. And being a director, I always have to think about this person's arc, this character's arc, against the other character's arc. That's been really helpful. And I always think if I had to do my acting against a blue screen, it would contribute to that as well. So I felt like I had my muscles flexed and kind of ready to do that.
I would prefer it if you stay out there, that you not come in here.
I don't think I can fit it.
You sure? You sure you're not coming in here? Oh, Lord, keep me safe.
Actor-comedian Dean Johnson.
But you know, I love the old tunes the best. The older, the better.
You deal much in 78s?
Oh, sure. Step right this way.
Oh, gosh, this is amazing. You've got a few more than I do.
There are about 28,000. Some collectibles, some not so much. Want to hear some? I'll crank up the old Victrola if you're serious.
Well, no. I'm looking for something specific. Do you have anything by Kit Jeffers?
Kit Jeffers? Boy, you're digging deep. That's way back. Not as influential as Alberta Hunter or Bessie Smith. My favorite was Josephine Baker.
But you know Kit Jeffers?
Well, she was local.
I've heard that.
She was young, but people took notice. Mixed a little bit of blues and local flavor in with the Tin Pan Alley sound. something different about her voice that was just haunting, raw. Probably too different. I could have been Mr. Epstein, really, in a different life, just a little bit different, because I spent so much of my childhood and adulthood, too, looking through record bins and record stores. I would have just had to go over to the other side of the counter, and I would have been Mr. Epstein, you know, and I loved all those singers like that, singers and jazz musicians. And I went to, it was a Northrop Auditorium, I think it was probably in about 1978, Alberta Hunter gave a concert, and she was, I'd say, maybe 84 years old, and she sang for about an hour, and then she was leaving the stage, and everybody gave her this great applause and for an encore, and finally she came back and said, look, I'm just taking a break, I'm coming back. And she came back and did about another hour, it seemed like, almost.
Wow.
That's a lot of energy, you know. That's
an 84-year-old.
Yeah. And she had a piano player and a bass player. And I loved it so much, I can still remember that she gave little talks, you know. Write to your parents, she would say. Be sure and don't forget about your parents. If you make a dime, save a nickel. All this kind of... grandmotherly advice. She was, but she could sing. She was fabulous. So that was exciting for me just to see her name in the script, you know.
You also told us a story about running into a guy who actually owned a record shop.
Well, I run into him all the time. I ran into his mother this afternoon. And she's quite old. She's over 90 years old. But anyway, this guy, his name is Scott, and he has vintage records on 38th and Cedar.
Oh, yeah.
And he has literally millions of 78 RPM records. So to go in there, you know, it's an amazing thing to do. And I go in there every once in a while. Just being in that place is a good way to think about being Mr. Epstein, you know, and see what the way Scott is about it. He's very serious about the whole thing. It sort of helped me get, you know, an idea of how to be a record store man.
We did all the casting over the phone. You know, just call them up and have them read some lines. And this is audio. I don't know, have to know what they look like, but it's always then funny meeting them. And like Tom Joyle, he sounded like 6'6". He sounded like the biggest, hugest guy in the world. And it was just this little old gentleman. It was like... and he was playing the bad guy. He was playing Mr. Behringer. He was playing the guy who pushes the timeline and pushes things a little bit in the play. And his voice could do it. It was just, he just looked very unassuming. And then the opposite was Charlie Meisner, who was playing Denny. And, you know, Charlie's got to be like 6'2" or 6'3". And... he sounds like the most unassuming, hippie-ish guy you'd ever want to meet, which he is.
When Jackie came in to do her audition, and I was recording it here, she came in having seen only the scene that we sent her about old Alice, and she already had Alice's backstory written in her head. She knew what this was about. She knew who this person was. She knew she was like her relatives that she had. So she knew the background and everything. And then I told her more of what the story was about. And her backstory changed and grew bigger. So by the time she was here to perform that thing, she had already practically lived it a couple of times. She knew Alice's whole civil rights history. So I'm not at all surprised that she would know what that character, well, what was happening in there. She'd been there.
There was just something about that character that I recognized, and I just went with my gut feeling and the recognition of that woman.
Is that somebody you know or a relative?
I know, it's funny, isn't it? I can't really tell you. I just know her as either a role model or... an aunt that I had in a past life. She's a Rosa Parks type figure, or even a Nellie Stone Johnson, a Minnesota activist, African-American woman. And I think you gave me a piece of information that helped me come to grips with that, because I guess I hadn't realized that the character would have also have been an activist. And in the 1920s and 30s, an African-American woman taking up that role as a civil rights activist would have been first extraordinary, and then she would have had to have been quite impressive to make her mark. And you made me understand that Alice Jeffers would have been that woman. And so I came from that point of view when I made my mind up about who she was.
One of the great challenges of playing Kit is that she lives in this world where there's a gender threat, there's racial violence threat that she has to contend with. And she wakes up in this place, she doesn't know where she is, and so there's this very palpable fear because she doesn't know where she is, who has her. At first, she doesn't think there's anything wrong, but once the fear creeps in, that begins to define every moment of her existence. But there's also this fantastic curiosity that is also building about where she is. Once she realizes she's in a place where the gender violence and racial violence is not such a threat with this guy, then she begins to be curious. And she pokes around inside of the computer. And then the curiosity turns into a type of empowerment. She can actually touch things and have them open at her command. And when she begins to read the thesis, she may not understand all the science of it, but she gets it enough to know that this is a chance to right an old wrong. And so that journey from not knowing where you are, complete ignorance, into fear, into curiosity, into empowerment is quite an arc to go through.
The music.
Musically, I find myself more and more attracted to the roots of the modern forms of blues and rock and gospel. And there's something so real and so mysterious about a song like St. James Infirmary or Forget Me Not Blues. And I just find myself going to YouTube and listening to older and older recordings. And as a lyricist, it's a really great experiment to try to find the right word choices and rhythms to match those old songs. For writing the melodies, I turned to my old friend and songwriting partner, Mike Wheaton. I'm pretty sure the first time I saw him in high school, he was playing some boogie-woogie on a banged-up piano in the gym. Mike's become a very accomplished pianist and guitarist and arranger, and has worked on all kinds of styles, from rock to Caribbean riffs to gospel, and we've written in all those styles. And I couldn't think of anybody I'd trust more with the tunes in the Embers. So here's Mike.
Since 2009, I've been playing piano for a gospel choir, and as always, learning about yet another category of music, all the artists, the history, and styles. Now, backing up a choir has really taught me to tighten up my chops and frame the vocalists. I find myself arranging as I'm playing. Play this little bit after the singer finishes a phrase, and this other little bit to lead into the chorus. For In the Embers, Brian asks for styles of jazz and blues from the 20s and 30s. Now, I've played ragtime for years, so it wasn't too hard to get myself into the songs and styles that I needed to write for it. I think the weirdest thing is just getting used to there being like almost no drums in the songs. Brian gave me a list of artists to listen to: Billie Holiday, Gershwin, Cole Porter, Ella Fitzgerald, Louis Armstrong. And I would just play YouTubes of their songs to pick up instrumentation patterns and chord progressions to use for inspiration to write for the play.
I've been a musician of one sort or another for kind of most of my life. trying to play instruments, flute, saxophone, bassoon, piano, but always having jazz really as the backdrop because my house was always filled with jazz. So I think in a way, my entry point to Kit is more through the music than it was in a way through the text. That's what kind of anchors me into a time period and a feeling. I think with the three songs that Kit sings, my Columbine was probably the most intimate and personal. So that was my first way in. And I really did have to sit with it for a while.
Springtime comes, you're at the edge of the wood. Makes my heart.
My Columbine? This song was actually harder to write, harder to get started on, than the others because it was supposed to be written by a young girl. And I wasn't quite sure how to do that. I finally got going on it by just kind of trying to write something with a nursery rhyme sort of feel.
And part of it was because we were separate. You know, you guys being out there and me being out here, I couldn't actively collaborate. I couldn't swing along with my pianist or my composer, which is what I'm used to doing. I'm used to working with somebody and playing around with things, and they make a gesture, and vocally I respond to it. So I think in our context, it probably took me a little longer.
In the Embers was tougher. Brian sent me the lyrics, and I started writing a jazzy, ragtimey kind of thing. I think we went around a few times on some of the changes. Probably after two or three tries, he was happy with it, and I thought we were good. When Brian started working with Robin Miles on the song, it started to get a little tougher. She was used to working things out in person, and we were working over the web. Finally, she realized she needed a key change on it, and there were a few musical sections that needed to be redone. What came out in the end was this gorgeous, gorgeous tune, and with Robin singing this amazing 20 styles vocal. So In the Embers is a jazzy 20s torch song that has some great instrumentation. I had a good time creating the horns and the strings for this.
Jackie, you play some of this music on your show.
I do, and in fact, I can speak to some of the authenticity of the music because it's dead on. Yeah. It's absolutely perfect. Not just Alberta Hunter-ish, but it's also Chippy Hill-ish, Bessie Smith-ish. So I'm going to have to take exception. When you call it jazz music, it's actually the blues. The voices, I don't know who chose the Robin Miles, is that her name?
Yeah.
Dead on perfect. She sounds just like a woman would if she had been recording in the 1920s and 30s. And it's very authentic and it really hit home, especially Gorgeous Boy. I really enjoyed that piece of music.
Once Gorgeous Boy clicked for me, it all started to roll into place. Because there's a lot of her personality that comes out in that. There's a flirtatiousness that comes out in it. There's a little rebelliousness. You know, she's into town and she's, you know, looking to find this boy. So I that's what I found anyway, that her personality was kind of embedded in that song.
Now, My Gorgeous Boy was a nice folk blues piece and fell together pretty quickly. That I hope has an old-time feel, like the song Hard Times or Down to the River to Pray. Interesting thing, the choir director of the gospel choir I play for asked me for a song about building bridges. So I came home and I took the melody from My Gorgeous Boy and I just flipped the chorus and the verse. And I used that.
My bridge to you.
Okay, so a fictitious song supposedly written in the 1920s becomes a real-life gospel song. How cool is that? Jerry Stearns and Tom Lopez.
Most of the music in this thing is what David Osman calls real music. It is not a background soundtrack. It is stuff that is someone in the scene is listening to on the radio or Kit singing it off the computer. It's sound that's actually in the scene and a part of it, but it still gets integrated so much into the story.
Yeah, very much so. Also, too, you know, when you anticipate that music is going to be there, and that is anticipated in the sense of when you write the script, it's so much different than someone who writes and produces a script and then decides, oh, it'd be nice to have some music. And that's how an awful lot of things, where you hear the music and it's kind of like, it's kind of background, you know, and doesn't really mean much. And the reason is that when you write and you know there's going to be music, the music is as important as another character. You don't like then after you finish say, oh, I'll add a character, you know. They'll talk in the background. That's kind of what the music does, generally speaking. But when you anticipate it right, you know, right from the start, as you did, then it's an essential part of it. It's part of the soul of the whole thing.
Then when we started thinking about music as, you know, transitions or background music, nothing came up. It just, you know, it just fought with the 20s sound. And so we ended up basically dropping, we didn't use any modern music at all. You know, as a, you know, like a soundtrack, which surprised me. I thought we'd have music all over the place, but it, you know, the only music that worked in the play just right was the character of Kit singing her own songs. The play said, "Nah, I don't want that stuff." So it solved some problems that way. Oops, you know, we forgot to mention that Robin Miles' daughter Olivia DeFord played Little Alice, Kit's sister. Olivia was a lot of fun. She was just this smart little 12-year-old bundle of energy. I'll let Robin explain.
We had a mother-daughter thing going on. It's not the first time we've played together in something, but in this case, we had to sing, which was the new part. And ironically, we sing all the time in our house because my husband's a musician and she plays guitar and he plays guitar and he makes charts all the time, and we sit around and we sing. We do that at Christmas, and, you know, some nights, you know, we don't turn on the TV. We just bust out the guitars, and I'm the voice, since I can't play. But she has an absolutely beautiful voice. Olivia has a really pretty voice, but I'm not sure she trusts it yet. And she sings at recitals. And everyone looks around and says, oh my goodness, what a nice voice. But I don't think she trusts it. So this was a great journey for us to go on together.
The sounds.
Tom Lopez.
The thing about audio drama, or radio drama as it's also called, is that partly because of the technology that's now at our fingertips, meaning you can have a broadcast quality studio in the palm of your hand with built-in microphones and everything. It's quite extraordinary. And radio drama, there's still so much more to discover. The old guys, you know, the greats, Orson Welles and Arch Obler, if they were around today, you know, still producing, strictly hypothetical, I realize, but they would not be doing old-time radio. They would be on the cutting edge and wanting to use these things that are now at our fingertips to be able to tell stories in ways that not only are more contemporary, more immediate to our lives, but also probably that visually, kind of probably more like cinema in a sense.
We really wanted the idea of the independent film to carry over into the soundtrack. We wanted it a very naturalistic sound and wanted it to sound real. And of course, it has to tell you what's going on, which is the function of sound effects. Naturalistic does not always mean genuine. We couldn't always use the actual thing to sound like that thing. So, for example, the sound of Tom climbing up on the bulldozer in that scene, Brian used a stick in a park and hit a few trash cans and metal installations and came up with a sound that worked for that. It's not the real thing, but it does sound like what people expect it to sound like. There's a scene where Tom and Cindy, the graduate students, and Behringer have a disagreement, and in the end they all march off in a huff in different directions, and they get in their trucks and drive away. Well, I came up with a set of sounds for Behringer's truck, slamming the doors, starting the truck and driving off, and then I had to come up with a different set of the same sounds for the graduate students. Probably a smaller truck, probably not in as much of a huff or a hurry. So they had to be different sounds, different trucks, and different emotional motivations behind them. The inside of the computer where Kit lives was one of the sounds that was most difficult to come up with. Having never been there, it was not something that anybody was going to know what it sounded like. We did some searches, and there were a lot of suggestions, but they all sounded like 1950s sci-fi movies, or very cartoony, or very musically electronic, like Tron. So we had to come up with something else that was both realistic and yet completely different than anything anybody else had been using. Eventually, we found some music that we knew of, and we used a very small piece of that. Then we used it in the background behind the voice, and we made it move. We used some processing to change the timbre. We changed it in stereo from left to right. We changed it in volume from foreground to background. It was the movement of that background that really made it work. We also processed the voice on top of it, so that had its own movement separate from the background sound.
The soundscape for the inside of the computer took a while to find. It was about the last big sound we had to come up with. We finally got that swirling feel we wanted on Saturday night, and the final mix was on Monday. It was that close. Then I realized, oh crap, you know, maybe we should have made the computer sound long, long before we recorded the actors, so Robin could have heard the background and reacted to it as Kit. Here Robin explains she'd already been there.
Well, I guess in a way I was surprised only because I constructed a landscape in my own mind. I always have a visual landscape in my mind when I work vocally. And I was talking to someone I collaborate with who's a filmmaker, and he said, that's really interesting. I think really visually when I work in film, but I don't think visually when I work voiceover. And I said, well, I do, because the voice carries emotion and subtext that immediately gives me a sense of place. Or in a response, and I start to see things. So for me, I'm responding to stimuli, and that means, what can I touch? Is it cool? Is it warm? What can I see? Is it fuzzy around the edges? Am I in a completely black box? If I found myself waking up in a room and everything was dark, the first thing I think I'd want to do is find the edges of that room and see if there's a door or there's a window. You know what I mean? So that's what I went through. And I'm not sure if that, I'm not sure if it translates as well into, like what I thought of vocally. I can only talk about what I saw visually to use as stimuli.
And it is so visual. And the thing about the production that you all did, Embers, it also has this quality of you're going out there and gathering things like the bulldozers and all these things, which are so wonderfully real and puts you in scenes that are locations, you know, and that's what I love about this medium, because it's such a visual medium, and we still have much more to discover.
Jerry Stearns and Gordon Smooter talk about how acting and huge sound effects fit together.
Gordon, there was a scene in where Tom and Cindy and Digger, I think, are all at the construction site.
Mm-hmm.
And Tom decides he's going to steal the bulldozer. It's like working against a green screen. You had to talk mm-hmm. over something that wasn't there.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And that's, I guess I never really found that to be difficult, because there's so much noise going on in my head all the time that I kind of feel like I'm talking over it anyway. But you know, it's your imagination, and well, when we're doing live radio type shows and things like that, you know, doing the radio dramas, that acting has to come from somewhere. And if you don't have the real thing there, it's got to come out of your imagination. So, you know, just thinking, and I've been around large equipment. I know what that sounds like. So it was just a matter of turning on that sound effect in my head and imagining that everyone else can hear it too. And just kind of, you know, but of course we weren't shouting. We were fake shouting. Then there's all kinds of different ways to do that. You can either be in control of your vocal volume, or you can turn away from the microphone, or, you know, all kinds of different ways to deal with that. And, you know, you guys didn't really tell me I was doing it wrong, so I just kept doing it the way I was doing it.
All right, hop on. Now I think we'll just amble over there and try to see what's under that concrete slab.
Steady, steady, be gentle.
How do you be gentle with a bulldozer?
I'm going to try to push the slab off the foundation that way. Hang on.
You get it! There's an open space under there. Huh. I thought it would be solid ground.
Now, another thing we theater types like to do with sound is wreck it, degrade it. We don't want things to sound perfect. Perfect isn't real. This drives engineers nuts. They get the perfect microphone, perfect levels, and then we scratch it all up and make the recording sound real. Here's a good example. Robin Miles, with her gorgeous voice, singing a few bars of In the Embers before we made it into a 78 RPM record, and then after. There's a little
where
difference.
Where the heart is concerned, I guess we'd be the lucky ones. 'Cause they say the lucky ones are the ones that get burned.
Once you were my hottest flame, paraded you all round town.
We just wanted the sounds to be a part of the world and that they're all living in. And if nobody noticed the sounds, then they're working. That's good.
Isn't it amazing? I got voices. Want me to play it again?
No, I don't want you to play it again.
You sure?
Yes, Digger, I'm sure. It's disturbing.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, something's going on. A fire or something. Are these real voices? Not computer voices?
No, Susan, it's not sampling.
Real girl voices?
Yeah, it's digitized from captured sounds from charcoal I got from a barn.
How does charcoal give you sound?
Audio archaeology. I've been working on it. I think I invented it. It's so cool. I use a laser on wood like a needle on a record.
The science.
There are three kinds of big science fiction ideas in this play. We talked about all three of them constantly and worked on them a lot. First, there was the idea of audio archaeology. Then the idea of digitizing a person or a personality into a computer. I think that happened to an uncle of mine once. And finally, the idea of time travel. This is a conversation of Jerry and I discussing it over Skype, just like we always did. Technology again.
I had an idea years ago of digging down into the ground in the street out in front of the radio station, taking core samples, and then being able to read the sound off of those, and finding all these different languages because that particular neighborhood has been a ethnically diverse over many years, and it changes periodically. So I thought if I go deep down in it, I'd get all the Swedes from when it was called Swede Hollow. And then further up, I would get the, in the 60s, it was when all the Vietnamese and the Hmong moved into the neighborhood. And now it's full of Ethiopians in the neighborhood. So I would get all these diverse languages picking up from that. So I've had that kind of audio archaeology idea for a long time.
Well, then what it came around to is, yeah, the sound could be there, so how would you get it to play back?
Yeah, that was a problem with the core sample things, but I really loved the idea of being able to read it out of the wood, and it seemed to me the only thing you could use would be a laser, because you could get down into the deep grooves. And you would use a laser these days rather than actually sticking a nail in there or a fine needle like you would on a record.
Now, what's interesting is as we were doing this show, a friend sent me a internet link to an article about a German magazine, a German scientist who had taken an 1880s photograph of a LP, so a round record, had photographed it and digitized the grooves of the record and played it on a computer. And so he took a photograph of a record. He didn't take actually the record, but he took a photograph of the record and made it play. And so it's getting really close to what we ended up doing. I hadn't thought about this, but where we use the idea of a laser to go back and forth and play back the sound that was grooved into this piece of wood, for whatever reason, absorb the sound. From that article, you could basically take a picture of the piece of wood, digitize it, and then figure out a way to play the piece of wood and play the sound in there.
I always imagined it as having something to do with the fire making the wood softer, or even being recorded in it because the charcoal was being created at the time that they were talking. And so to me, there was more than just being embedded in wood because it was there. There was a reaction going on with the events at the same time.
Yeah, exactly. Then I think reaction is what a lot of the science in the play is about, is it's not just that, you get into a time capsule and go somewhere. It has to have fire and lightning and emotion to time travel. And the same thing with the recording of capturing a person's voice in wood took fire and emotion and the right context.
It might have been that it wouldn't have been recorded if there hadn't been a very emotional thing going on, and we wouldn't have been able to make the connection with Kit in the future without that emotion being embedded in it too. It's interesting that all of that kind of preservation happens naturally, and there is almost no way to be able to duplicate that with science, even modern science. Yeah, the circumstances have to be just right to get it to happen.
And luckily, we found those circumstances and were able to. And that was an interesting part of the play that we used really seriously, especially with the post-production and the actors, was we played we call them artifacts. We played the recording to Digger, and so he had something to react to. But it was always going to be that recording. We weren't going to change it because it was like, that's what you got out of the wood.
Yeah, there it was incomplete sentences. It was It was not a whole conversation. It was enough to give you some context and some emotional setup for the whole thing.
I'm in a brain.
Yeah, I guess. Kind of like an electric brain.
What? I'm electric.
Yes, I think you are. God, I cannot believe I am talking like this.
What are you doing with these pictures of Tool Hill? Look at all these pictures. I haven't seen these people in years.
Hey, how are you getting those to flash up on the screen?
I don't know. I saw something this year at Tool Hill, Anne Arundel Historical Society. I touched it.
You touched it and the files just opened?
Nothing open. I just see pictures. Oh, there's Daddy and Mama on the porch. And the tall barn.
But and then the piece of science was the idea of then digitizing somebody's being into a computer, which is often used. Again, what we did is we figured that there had to be emotion and energy to put somebody into a computer. You can't just walk into a computer or walk into being digitized. You'd have to have, in our case, some lightning, and then we threw in, you know, a little bit of Columbine, and you know, I actually sort of ended up with a magic mixture to get Kit into the computer. When In the Ember sort of becomes a little bit of a ghost story, which is how the whole thing started out to a degree, was that the sort of character and being of Kit Jeffers was a personality in a person who had something more to say and something to resolve. You know, she wasn't complete. So then Digger finding this artifact of sound recording, and then finding artifacts of actual, you know, studio recordings of Kit singing, combined with Kit's being, where they were at the gravesite, you know, all combined with energy to put her into the computer, with, you know, and basically putting her into the computer was a way for her to be able to communicate. Well, let's go on and talk about time travel. Because again, thinking about this, the time travel, I think, was a little different in our story, and we were looking for something different to do with time travel because we didn't want to just get in a box and wind it up and go somewhere, which I really don't believe anyway. I think it was really neat to try to come up with a solution for mass and time travel, because the whole problem with most things is, you know, to get to the speed of light or get beyond the speed of light would cause infinite mass. You would have something would weigh so much that it couldn't go anywhere to get to the speed of light. So what we decided to do is come up with something that you would send in time that had no weight at all. And so that was a motion. And so that's what the character Susan then talks about in her paper. So we didn't write the paper. We probably should have written the paper. A lot of times we have.
Well, you had talked about wanting to do the time travel, and we'd talked about the fact that there was no way to do. I mean, she's an imaginary person. She's not a physical presence, Kit. So how would we get her to go back? And I had just read something. I'm not even sure I remember where, but I just read something about the idea of quantum tunneling, where subatomic particles of one atom were the same subatomic particles going around another atom in another part of the universe, and that they were interconnected. And so we kind of took that idea, at least a part of it, and threw that into the story, which helped us make the connection. And it's not so much a physical or a geographical connection, because they essentially were happening in the same place. The computer was already there. So she was geographically already properly located, and it just had to have that emotional connection. Now, there's something the scientists haven't come up yet with. The Higgs boson is an interesting thing, but what is the emotion particle that they haven't discovered yet? And again, it was a natural event. It was not something that anybody tried to do, or for that matter, would have been able to do, no matter what they knew about the process. It happened purely by accident and natural phenomenon.
So time travel is possible?
Really?
Yeah, really.
But wait a minute, what about the speed of light and infinite mass and all that?
Well, I've thought about that.
Oh, she's thought about it.
Physicists are supposed to think outside the universe. Okay, so you're right, Tom. Certainly nothing solid could time travel. Anything as small as a needle, a bead, much less a human being or a spaceship. Anything with weight, with mass, is way too heavy to send back in time. It would take an infinite amount of energy to send the smallest object doubling, tripling the speed of light enough to turn back time.
So, I don't understand. What could go faster than the speed of light?
Intangibles. An intent. Feelings. Wants. Experiences. Emotions.
Emotional time travel. I'd love it.
Finally, Jackie, Maddox, and Jerry sit around the table discussing the motives and literally the life and death changing consequences of traveling back into time.
In the original future where Alice passed away and Kit lived, Kit became a drunkard. Her life was wasted. And I imagined the character went that route because she lost her sister and she was unable to save her sister. So she chose to go back in time, which changed all of time and changed the future in which Digger is in. And she was more than happy to do that, knowing that her life meant something. She went back in time knowing that she would die, but her sister would live because she had wasted the life anyways. And she knew her sister would do something with that life in a time-space continuum. She knew something was going to happen. Somebody had to go. And she already was trapped in this box. And she wasn't going to get out of the box, more or less. Coffin, box, mm-hmm. That she was making a choice. If she had to go back and make things right, she didn't care. But I think the whether Kit actually exists or not, I think that's part of Digger's quandary, because he doesn't know if it's all in his own head. Mm-hmm. Is this really real? Could any of the science that his girlfriend was talking about, could that really exist? And then here's this person trapped in this computer, or is he imagining the whole thing? He still doubts his own sanity. And then he goes back through the town after she's changed time, and he's still confused. He still doesn't know, am I going crazy or not? He doesn't, and he's the only one who doesn't get changed by time.
Oh, that's an interesting point. I hadn't thought of that.
Because he recognizes that he's going back through seeing the signs that didn't belong there before.
Yeah,
like Jeffers Farm.
Yeah, he's the only one that knows all of the facts.
There. He is Marty McFly.
There you go.
Exactly. So he's still doubting his sanity, because then he's looking at stuff that wasn't there before. He's still kind of, help me, you know.
One of my favorite things about that little middle section there is the character arc of Kit, who believes she's real at the beginning, but doesn't know where she is or what's going on, and she doesn't know what concept of what, even what a computer is. And there's that scene, and then the next scene, she's already starting to, you know, she sees him, she sees all these pictures of her old, the old plantation. By the end of it, they say, you know, what do you mean? What does that mean? Susan says, what do you that mean that she uses the computer better than I do? You know, Digger says that.
Mm-hmm.
And Kit goes and does something. She brings up all the sounds. She brings up all the pictures. She brings them up all at once, does everything at once. And nobody can figure out how she's doing that. And she doesn't know how it is. So she has this arc of being completely unaware of everything. Of anything.
And being helpless.
Yeah, and being helpless. And by the end of it, she's the one who has better control over everything than anybody else in the place.
Mm-hmm.
That to me is just a remarkable thing that Brian mostly came up with how that arc was supposed to go and laid it out in such a nice way. He and I talked about where it should begin and where it should end, but he laid it out nicely that way.
Well, to me, it kind of spoke to a concept within the African-American community where, especially in that time frame, 1910, 1920, 1930s, where black people were careful not to let white people know how smart you were. You hid it, either under being an entertainer or being funny, you know, or being subservient. And Kit, at first, kind of was playing that way to Digger until she could figure out how to make it work to her advantage. And then when she realized she wasn't going to be harmed by being this smart person, she let it all come out. Because he couldn't get in the box, she couldn't get out of the box, and it was safe for her to just show her intelligence. So in a way, I'm sure Brian didn't understand that, but that's one of the things that I say rings true for the African-American community, because that is a survival skill. You don't let white people know that you know what you know. You try to hide that, because the smarter you are, the more you are in danger of being harmed.
You know, it's interesting that all of this happened because of the emotions of the characters being embedded, being shoved around, being transmitted. Boy, it sure comes out. I know there are at least three places in that thing that every time I hear that, I break down in tears. So the emotion comes out of it, certainly.
Let's let Robin Miles and Kit have the last word.
Well, to me, it's a sacrifice that she was already willing to make and was more angry and disappointed in herself for not being able to make it, meaning she would have sacrificed herself for her sister anyway. And in a way, it's her opportunity to finally make that right. She failed the first time. She's not about to fail the second time.
Gonna be a fire?
She knew. Yes, she knew. But you know what?
What?
I told Kit not to leave me. I screamed at her not to leave me. But she went back into the barn. Then, a little minute later, horses come running out. Then a cow come running out. Every one of them creatures come running out. But Kit, she didn't come back out. Lord, my Kit never come out.
What about Danker?
He didn't come out.
Danker died in the fire?
Of course he did.
Then who foreclosed on your parents and the farm?
Well, nobody. What are you talking about? Had to rebuild the tall barn down the road. That's what Daddy did. But that farm's still in my family. Will always be in my family.
They didn't have to sell.
I
guess we'd be
the lucky ones. I like hearing Kit's voice. I haven't heard her voice in a thousand years. It's a different voice, though. She sounds like a grown woman there, just singing her blues.
Yeah.
Young man, are you sure?
About what?
Are you sure? You say this song's for me. I never heard it before.
Yes, Miss Alice. That song's for you. Kit sang it for you.